Good evening, and welcome to VPR's Eye on the Sky Stargazing Party. I'm Rick Singeri, and our guest tonight is Mark Breen, who you know well from our daily Eye on the Sky weather reports and the Eye on the Night Sky program, which you hear at 4:30 in the evening on VPR. Mark is also the planetarium director at the Fairbanks Museum in St. Johnsbury, and he has extensive knowledge of the night sky. Mark, so good to have you with us again.
So glad to be here.
All right. This program is presented in collaboration with the Fairbanks Museum. We're asking you to go out to your backyard with a blanket and a radio, maybe your iPhone with the VPR app. Take a look at the night sky and follow along with Mark and me. Mark, it looks like in most places the weather's going to cooperate with us tonight. Is that right?
Yes. Right now, western parts of the region, particularly the Champlain Valley, seeing some clouds collect in there along with some localized brief heavy downpours. And yet, at the same time, clear skies through much of eastern and southern Vermont, much of central and southern New Hampshire, and over into the Berkshires. Our listeners down there enjoying some clear skies and some partly sunny skies, or partly cloudy skies, rather, out across eastern New York.
So the majority will have a good viewing evening tonight.
Right.
So let's start with a little orientation, looking at the moon. What are we looking at when we see little specks of light next to the moon?
Yeah, the moon tonight's in its what we call its first quarter, which basically it's half illuminated, and it means it's a quarter of the way through its cycle of phases. But to the left of the moon, to the right of the moon,
all right,
we find a relatively bright spark of light. That's actually the planet Saturn sitting there. And if you look just below Saturn and maybe just slightly to its right, there's a star located there as well. Now, farther to the right and yet a little bit lower, and maybe with a hint of kind of a salmon orange color, that's the planet Mars that's residing there. Mars has been in the sky throughout the winter and spring and now into summer, so it's been providing an extended viewing time, so that's kind of nice. And you can almost draw a line from Saturn to Mars and then extend it a little bit more to the right and, again, a little bit lower. There you'll find a star that's kind of flickering a little bit in the twilight that's now fading. And that's the star Spica sitting over there. Spica is actually one of the brighter stars in the sky. And so this trio has been sort of dancing around, if you will, gradually rearranging their positions, and with some more to look forward to. In the next few weeks, Mars and Saturn will actually pass relatively close together.
Oh, that sounds beautiful. Any significance to Spica?
It, as a star, it's a pretty amazing star. Spica is, and I think folks, if they look at it, one of the things that you might notice, it is kind of a bluish color. And so that's an indication of just how hot this star is. This is a relatively, I suppose a blue is cold, but in this particular case, think of a flame instead. And a blue-colored flame, like a gas flame or something, is a very hot flame, whereas red embers would be, relatively speaking, on the cool side. So we're looking at Spica, we're looking at a star whose temperature is somewhere in the neighborhood of 22,000 degrees. Now, just for comparison, our sun on that scale is around 6,000 degrees. So it's tremendously hotter as far as that's concerned. And it's approximately seven times wider than our sun. So
wow.
It's a fairly large star as well.
That's incredible. Okay, so that does have some significance.
Yeah.
how about any other bright stars, maybe if we turn our gaze southwesterward?
Yeah, well, actually, and we shift maybe just a little bit to the left of the moon, and there another curious and certainly kind of a favorite star of sorts. It's a reddish-colored star positioned just a little bit lower than the moon, and there we find a red star known as Antares. Now, Antares, flickering a little bit. It's something that stars tend to do, especially as they get nearer the horizon. But Antares, the red color, is a nice contrast to Spica, which we just mentioned as being a bluish-colored star. So Antares, by contrast, is a cool-temperatured star, if you want to think of it that way. Again, it's still obviously very hot, but we're talking in some ways about the surface temperature. And so by comparison, again, I mentioned that Spica was around 22,000, our sun at around, well, actually 5,800 degrees. And so on that scale, Antares comes in at 3,400 degrees.
Gotcha. I'm speaking with Mark Breen of the Fairbanks Museum and Planetarium, and he is the host of the Eye on the Night Sky on VPR. We're asking you tonight to turn your eyes to the night sky along with us. If you have questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call now, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. If you'd like to send an email, you can do so. That goes to community@vpr.net. Mark, one of the most popular constellations on view tonight is the Big Dipper. So where do we find that?
Well, we have to kind of swing around into the other spot in the sky. One of the things about the Big Dipper, it's certainly an easy and a helpful thing to keep in mind, it is always in the north. So that kind of automatically gives you, you know, some guidance right there. Mm-hmm. In the summer months, you can always find it in the northwest. And so I kind of figure you look northwest, you'll look maybe a third of the way up in the sky. And for most folks that have even heard of the Big Dipper, perhaps you've seen it once or twice before, that's often enough to zero in on it, because there, even though we still have a bit of twilight and a little bit of moonlight as well, you'll probably find the seven medium bright stars that make up the Big Dipper. The handle is on the top part and kind of curving a little bit to the left. The Dipper itself, the Dipper portion or the bowl of the Dipper on the lower right part of it. The stars are all pretty much of equal brightness. It's one of the unique characteristics of the Big Dipper, and it's one of the few constellations that has kind of an even distribution of the stars all pretty much the same brightness in a relatively recognizable pattern.
Now, what I find interesting is we know it as the Big Dipper, but it has other names in other cultures. You familiar with some of those?
Oh, indeed. And in fact, technically, the Big Dipper isn't a constellation itself. The Big Dipper is a very common name for this pattern of stars. It's actually a pattern known as an asterism, which is just a fancy word meaning a pattern of stars. but the actual constellation that it's part of is known as Ursa Major, which is just the Latin name for the Great Bear or the Big Bear. And so it is actually known as the Bear in many different countries around the Northern Hemisphere. But as you mentioned, it's not really the only name that it goes by. In England, it often was referred to as the Plow. Mm-hmm. And if you can sort of take that same handle portion, imagine that as the handle on the plow, and then the plow itself is where the Dipper is sitting. Just kind of slice that in half so you get a triangle, cut it diagonally in half, and you wind up with a diagonal shape, and kind of imagine that wedge digging into the ground, and that final star out on the end would be the hitch for your horse or your oxen or whatever to pull it along. Now, in parts of Scandinavia as well as Germany, it is known as a wagon or a cart. In fact, in Germany, it's known as Karlswagen, which is Karl's wagon. And yet there are, you know, kind of some interesting interpretations. I know in India, in fact, I just saw a family here at the museum. They were from India, were talking about the Big Dipper and its various names. It's known as the Seven Rishi. Rishi would be a wise man. So there are the seven wise men in the sky as well.
And it's also depicted on the Alaska state flag, along with the North Star. So because it has so many names and fits in with so many different cultures, does it have a special place in cultures around the world?
Well, one of the things that, and this certainly tied into some Native American cultures somewhat locally, mm-hmm. Just to our west, the Iroquois tribes, look at the Big Dipper, also as a bear, but not with the same sort of configuration and pattern that, the say, the Greeks did. And so For the Iroquois, the four stars that we call the Dipper portion, that's actually the bear itself. No fancy picture, just that's where the bear is. And then the three stars that we think of or consider the handle, those are actually Indians hunting the bear.
Wow.
Each of them even has a job to do. So the one that's closest to the bear is the one carrying the bow and arrow to shoot him with. The second one has a pot to cook him in. And in fact, if you look very carefully at that star, just kind of above that star, there's a very faint star, but very close to it. That is the cooking pot itself. Finally, the last star, the one farthest out on the handle, that particular Indian is out gathering firewood to put underneath the cooking pot so when they finally catch the bear, they can have some fresh bear stew.
I love it. You can join the conversation if you have a question about what you're seeing outside, or if you want to let us know where you're viewing the night sky this evening, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. You can also email us at community@vpr.net. And Mark, we did hear from Brian in Burlington, who emailed, as a night sky photographer and amateur aurora hunter forecaster, I'm always looking for new places to shoot images in Vermont, but dark skies are getting harder and harder to find. Where are the darkest skies in Vermont, and what can we do as night sky enthusiasts to preserve the night sky and prevent light pollution that steals our starry view?
Mm-hmm. The two places that probably have the least amount of light pollution would be portions of the southern Green Mountains in the Green Mountain National Forest there, as well as portions of the Northeast Kingdom. And, you know, pretty much that's guided by the idea that fewer people mean fewer lights and light sources. So that's certainly, you know, part of the ingredients to that. There are things that people can do, and both as individuals, but also in somewhat larger situations. So as individuals, we can actually purchase lights that are designed to produce, you know, less light glare escaping out and away from the light, you know, going out, you know, say up into space. I mean, that light isn't something you're using anyway, so it's not really that efficient. So finding lights that are designed to shine simply down is very helpful. Now, at the same time, institutions can sometimes help out with that. And I know, for example, Linden State College, which isn't too far from where I am here, at Linden State College on the campus, they actually made a concerted effort to purchase lights that shine simply down. And from the time I was a student back several decades ago to now, I can personally see the difference on the campus that you can be on campus, a well-lit campus, you know, in terms of thinking about, you know, safety and that type of thing. And yet at the same time, you can look up and see a fairly dark night sky.
That's a great idea. Mark, we also heard from Hayden, who's 6 years old, and he asked a question we all want to know. He wants to know why the stars are twinkling.
Ah, Hayden, great question. And indeed, that's something we all observe. One of the things that we probably don't think about is that we're surrounded by this thick blanket of air. Now, we don't think of air as thick, but compared to outer space, it's really thick. And so as light travels through it, we have a couple of things going on. We have changes in temperature. The air isn't always the same temperature, and sometimes it sorts itself out into layers and that type of thing. And the thickness of the air, how thick or thin it is, depends on the temperature. So as the temperature changes, the thickness of the air changes. And what winds up happening is a beam of light, think of a nice straight beam, like, you know, one of those little laser pointers or something. Mm-hmm. That will, of course, go straight. Unless the temperature changes and therefore the thickness of the air changes. So what happens is instead of going straight, it bends just slightly. Then it bends back and, of course, it's back in line again. So when it bends away, the star or whatever source of light kind of fades for just a little bit. Then it lines up and it's bright again. So it fades and it brightens. It fades and it brightens. That's the twinkling. Now, that's a somewhat fancy explanation of it. We all see the same wavy pattern of light through the air. We just perhaps don't think about it. If you look over hot pavement, all right, you can sometimes see what we call the waves of heat coming off the pavement. that's exactly the same thing. Or in the wintertime, you're looking over, say, the wood stove, and you can see the waves of heat. That's light bending as it comes toward you. And so that's the same effect, and that is what causes the twinkling, which also means if you're in space, stars don't twinkle.
Oh, wow. I'll remember that next time I'm up there. You've mentioned in your Eye on the Night Sky reports the summer triangle. Where's that?
That's really, you know, I kind of consider that one of the keys to looking at the summer sky. It's a bright and recognizable pattern. So tonight, pretty much I would tell you, look straight up. Now, it's not perfectly straight up, but looking as much as you can determine that you're looking straight up, you will see a very bright star up there. That star is Vega, one of the brightest stars in the sky, second brightest in the summer sky, and it is the brightest in a trio of stars. Now, right at the moment, it's still high kind of in the east. So if you're looking in the east, but looking way up in the sky, more than two-thirds of the way up, you'll see another fairly bright star kind of to the lower left of Vega and a pretty wide space between them. And then to the lower right of both of them is another bright star kind of in between in terms of brightness, not as bright as Vega, a little brighter than that other star, and that's the third star. Now, by name, the other two stars, the fainter one, Deneb, D-E-N-E-B, and the somewhat brighter one is Altair.
Now, this has been referred to, I believe, this summer triangle has been referred to as the Navigator's Triangle. So, any idea how navigators use this group of stars?
Well, navigators use bright stars, their position and their timing, to be able to determine their position on the Earth. So, for example, that star that I mentioned, the really bright one that's near the top of the sky, Vega. Vega will be passing over the top of a particular location or close to it at a certain time of night. That even changes during the year simply because you're changing. The Earth is going around the sun, so it puts you in a different spot. But by knowing the timing of that, it actually determines where you are on the Earth. You need basically two things. You need a really good star chart so you know you're looking at the star you think you're looking at, but you also need a time device. You need to be able to know exactly what time it is so you can measure the position of the star, measure the time, and then you can check on a chart to see where that determines where you are.
So you mentioned some things you need. Are there some good tools for stargazers to take out with them as they look to the night sky?
Well, there are a couple of ways of doing it. I guess there's kind of the old-fashioned way of doing it. There are any number of excellent star books that have various charts to help describe what it is you're looking at. Because there are, on a very clear and dark night, it seems like there are just an endless number of stars, and therefore it's almost confusing as to, you know, what star am I really looking at? And am I looking at the one that's on this chart? So it can be somewhat confusing. Star charts certainly help to kind of break that out just a little bit. And sections of the sky like the Summer Triangle or the Big Dipper are very helpful because they're so distinct, so specific, that helps. Now, on the other hand, you can take a new application. There are some apps that people now have on their iPhones and their pads and tablets and so forth, and one of them is called Starwalk, where it actually displays what you're looking at as you move it around in the sky. It has a little GPS locator so it knows what direction you're pointing it in. And so I think that's another great way to identify what it is you're looking at.
Any constellations people can be looking for out there this evening, Mark?
Well, actually, let's go back to, because we had mentioned earlier a little bit about the moon and that bright red star off to its left. And that bright red star, Antares by name, is the heart of Scorpio, the scorpion. Now, Scorpio, that's one of those constellations that I think people would recognize simply by name, not necessarily even having looked at it in the sky at all, that because it's part of the horoscope. So some folks, whether you admit to it or not, I know you check your horoscope trying to see, you know, what your future is by the stars. Well, all of those names in the horoscope are constellations, patterns in the sky. So getting back to the red star, the red star is in basically the midst of a pattern that looks like the letter S. I think that's the easiest way to describe this. So if you look at the red star and then go left and down, you'll see there's a string of moderately bright stars. They curve right down to the horizon, and unless you have a perfectly flat horizon, you won't necessarily see the very bottom of that curve, but it actually does curl back up, and that's the curl at the end of the shape of this letter S. Now, if you go on the right side of the red star, you'll see there's a few stars that go out and then curve down to the right. So put it all together, and you can see this nice big S-shaped pattern. And that's really the key to finding Scorpio, because on the left, going down to the horizon, curling back up, that's the body and the tail of the Scorpion. To the right, you'll see, well, kind of a trio of stars, almost in a vertical line up and down. The brightest star is the middle of those stars, and that's the head of the Scorpion. After that, that's where the star chart or maybe that app on your iPhone may come in handy. There are these curved lines kind of extending out and then to the front of the Scorpion, out kind of up into the right and then down into the right. Those are the claws of the Scorpion. And so that's one of the constellations that it's relatively easy to find. It's one that, like I said, you know, it's a familiar name, so I think that's always very helpful. And one other key to thinking about the sky and what we're seeing is that the groups of stars that we know as the horoscope just by name, Sagittarius and Aquarius and so forth, they're also the constellations that the moon and the planets travel through. So being familiar with the Scorpion means you'll, at various points, see the moon moving through there. In fact, in the next couple of nights, the moon will slide just above that red star. And eventually, later this, in a couple of months, specifically, I think it's September 26th and 27th, Mars moves right above that red star.
Oh, my.
And in fact, there's an interesting thing because I mentioned the star's name is Antares, but Antares is an ancient Greek word. Anti, the first part of that, means rival of or not or against. The second part of the word, Aries, is the Greek name for Mars. So that star's name literally means the rival of or not Mars.
Oh, interesting. This is the Eye on the Sky Stargazing Party on VPR, speaking with Mark Breen from the Fairbanks Museum and Planetarium, and we'd love to hear from you. If you have a question about what you're seeing in the night sky, you want to tell us where you're watching the sky this evening, please give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also send an email to community@vpr.net. Mark, we were talking about the Big Dipper a little earlier. You mentioned that it's the key to understanding the night sky. So what does it help us find?
Okay, so we start with the Big Dipper. Again, you know, fairly easy to recognize. And one of the first things that I do, and it's kind of an automatic thing, and I think it's a great habit for anybody to be into, you use the stars of the Big Dipper to locate the North Star. And you do that by using the two stars that are on the outer edge of the bowl of the Dipper. So in this case, the ones that are lowest in the sky at the moment. If you connect the line between the two stars and then just extend that line to the right and a little bit higher, so you're still on that same straight line, go approximately the distance that the Big Dipper is wide. So in other words, you take the whole Big Dipper from tail to the front and you go that distance to the upper right, and you will come to a moderately bright star, not the brightest star in the sky, but a moderately bright star. That is Polaris, the North Star. So the Big Dipper locates your directions at night. That's pretty helpful right there, north,
sure
south,
is.
East, and west. Then that North Star is actually the end of the handle of the Little Dipper. So now we can add another constellation in. Now the Little Dipper, the handle part, curves up and bends to the left back toward the direction of the Big Dipper. But it's a smaller, you know, constellation, smaller pattern, so it doesn't go too far before you find a little box or rectangle of stars, the Dipper portion itself. Other constellations that I think are really helpful to recognize, The Big and Little Dippers are always in the sky throughout the year. That's not necessarily true of star groups like the Scorpion that we mentioned or the Summer Triangle. But if we instead think about where the Big Dipper is and the North Star that we just located, use that North Star as kind of the center point. And so if you go from the Big Dipper past that center point, the North Star, to the other side, you're going to find a W shape pattern of stars, essentially five stars, a little zigzag over in the northeast. And that is the Queen Cassiopeia, one of the relatively bright constellations. The only thing is it doesn't necessarily look much like a queen having the shape of a W. You can, with a fair amount of imagination, create a chair or throne over there. I think it's really helpful to you. So if you're looking north-northeast right now, and you try to imagine that as a chair, how does that work? Well, you go to the left, and you add just one more star on the extension of that W shape. So that's the back of the chair. So the chair is sideways in the sky right now, with the back of the chair to the left. And then as you go to the middle star in that W shape, and you go up, there's another little star in there. And that helps to form the seat of the chair. Finally, you have perhaps maybe three legs kind of sticking out to the right. Now, again, a little help from a star chart, a little help from that app on your iPhone or your tablet, and you'll be able to see that relatively easily.
That's brilliant. Hey, let's take a call from Barry. He's calling from Bennington. Barry, thanks for calling our stargazing party this evening. What's your question for Mark?
I often think of constellations as in a plane, you know, the same plane or the same distance from Earth, but I'm sure they're not. And I was interested to know just how far apart they can be. And, for example, take any constellation he chooses and give an idea about how far away, how far apart the various stars are from each other and from the Earth.
That's a great question. Mark?
Okay. So let's actually, the Big Dipper is a kind of a nice example of that.
Sure.
One thing that is helpful to think of is, although we see it, and Barry's kind of indicating this, you know, you kind of see it that it's all appears to be the same distance. Those stars are not the same distance away. Even though, you know, we don't think of it that way, as it turns out, some of those stars are more than, well, let's see, 100 light years farther from us than some of the other stars. So now we're starting to introduce some terms. So just very briefly, a light year is how far light travels in 1 year. In some ways, it's relatively simple. Giving it a number is a little bit more complicated. It's about 6 trillion miles. So then we're talking about 100 of those. So 600 trillion miles, that's a ridiculous number, I suppose, in terms of trying to imagine it with what we have for scale here on the Earth. The middle five stars in the Dipper, so in other words, not the very end of the handle and not the very outer kind of corner on the right. The middle five stars are actually all about the same distance away. They're actually a group of stars that is moving through space and staying and as a very loosely compact group. Now, the stars on either end are considerably farther away. The end star on the Dipper is approximately 75 light years farther away than the stars that I just mentioned. And so that distance, so when we look at it from the Earth, obviously it creates this pattern. If you were someplace else, you wouldn't necessarily even see a Dipper because they're not all the same distance away from us. And the stars of the Big Dipper are relatively close by. You know, we could also pick on Scorpio, for example. The star Scorpio, not necessarily all that far away, but it's certainly more distant, approximately 470 light years away. So, and still a relatively nearby object out there. So when we start talking about constellations, they're all at various distances away. They just appear because of such a great distance. They all kind of appear the same distance away. All the stars that you see, all of them are in the Milky Way galaxy. So in some ways, they can't be any farther than 100 million light years away.
Oh, right next door. You're listening to the Eye in the Sky Stargazing Party on VPR. You can join our conversation about what you see when you look up into the August skies. We're also going to be talking about meteor showers coming up. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can send an email to community@vpr.net.
I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway. Join me at 2 weekday afternoons to catch up on what's going on in the world and hear stories and perspectives you won't hear elsewhere. Newsmakers, experts, and people affected by the news, all part of the conversation and all part of your conversation, too, we hope. Listen at 2 for The Takeaway Monday through Thursday and Science Friday on Friday right here on VPR.
And there's a new program coming to Sunday mornings on VPR Classical. Listen at 11 for the VPR Choral Hour. It's a celebration of the rich and varied world of choral music. Host and singer Linda Radke brings you performances by local Vermont groups and classic recordings of major choral works. Tune in to the VPR Choral Hour, Sunday mornings at 11 on VPR Classical.
Welcome back to the Eye on the Sky Stargazing Party on VPR. I'm Rick Sengary, and we're inside the studio at the moment, but you could be outside taking in the clear view of the night sky. Just take your radio outside and join us. And if you have questions for our guest, Eye on the Sky meteorologist Mark Breen, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can send your questions or comments to community@vpr.net. So, Mark, August is a hot time for meteor showers. So tell us about them.
Yes, every August, it's one of the things that I think I certainly hear from a lot of people. They've kind of gotten used to the idea that August is the time to go out and look for shooting stars, as the common term is, or meteors. And that all is keyed around a particular pattern. It's known as the Perseid meteor shower. It occurs every year, peaking on the night of August 11th into the morning of August 12th. And it does so in a very regular fashion and has been for thousands of years. It goes back well before 2,000 years ago. And so we have some records going back that far that every year in August, this same display takes place. Some years a little better, some years not quite so bright. And some of that has to do with the moon. Now, the reason that it's such a nice and regular thing has to do with the nature of what we know as meteor showers. I mean, now a meteor, a shooting star, a falling star, is something that you can see any clear night of the year, just happen to catch one here and there. But there are these certain periods of time during the year, and August is certainly up on that list. There are times where you can see not just one or two. You might see 10, 12, you might see 20, you might even see 30 of them in the space of an hour. Now, that means one every other minute. That's a pretty interesting display to be out there witnessing. And so the reason that there are so many of them has to do with the Earth moving through, in its orbit, the debris trail of an old comet. As comets, now, so we're introducing yet another object, but the two of them are very much related, and I think it's helpful to think of both of them. Mm-hmm. Comets are made out of ice, but they have embedded in that ice different tiny little pieces, little fragments of rock. And so those fragments of rock, as the sun blasts away at the ice that the comet is made out of, the little fragments are released. It's released, in fact, behind the comet, being pushed by the energy of the sun, so we get a tail on the comet, kind of a classic look as far as the comet itself is concerned. So you've got debris that's going out there. Well, if you can think of the comet in orbit around the sun, as they are, if it keeps moving on that same orbit year after year, The debris, those tiny little fragments of rock, are also in orbit. And so they are not moving very quickly, but they stay in this ring, this debris ring. And so if the debris ring happens to intersect or come very close to the Earth's orbit, every year we travel through that debris. Every year we run into those particles. And every year those particles enter our atmosphere, burn up. And so we see that display that we know as shooting stars or meteors. So that's why every August 11th and 12th we see those meteors.
And these are called the Perseids. Why is that?
Well, it turns out they appear to come from a constellation named Perseus. So one of the language things that I learned mostly by being an astronomer, I had nothing to do with learning languages, but in Latin, the tag end of the word id means belonging to. So the Perseids belong to Perseus. And so that's how they get their names. And there are different meteor showers throughout the year. The Perseid meteor shower, one of the more prolific, at its peak, it can produce in the neighborhood of 60 meteors per hour. So about one a minute. Now, there are a couple of little catches with that. One, you don't want moonlight out there. And this year, one of those years where we are going to have a fair amount of moonlight, so that's going to reduce the number you'll see. The other thing that's kind of curious is that you see more of them after midnight than you do before. So the best time to see them is like 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. We decided not to do a star party at 3 o'clock in the morning, thinking a few of you may be sleeping.
But including me.
Yeah. So what happens is, if you think about the Earth in its orbit around the sun, in the evening, obviously the sun is setting. So you are curving, and the Earth is spinning, you're turning away from the sun. But after midnight, you're turning back toward the sun, and you're also turning back into the direction that we're traveling around the sun. So basically it's like running into the particles. So after midnight, since you run into more particles instead of moving away from them, you see many more of them.
Now, Mark, I don't want to call out scientists, but does the scientific community truly understand meteors?
Yes and no. It's one of those things where it is a relatively new branch of astronomy. When I say relatively new, let's face it, astronomy is perhaps the oldest science. We've been looking at stars and going back, certainly prehistory. We're talking about people keeping track of the stars and measuring time and that sort of thing. But in terms of studying meteors, that really began in the 1800s. And it was really in its infancy through the 1800s. It really wasn't until the 20th century, the 1900s, that we got a little better idea about exactly what meteors were, the nature of them and so forth. So what do we know? We know that most of them, and so that's already going to leave at least some of them that this doesn't apply to, but most of them are tiny fragments of rock, and they are, as it appears by aging, the ones that have landed here on the Earth, they are 4.55 billion years old, which matches our understanding for the beginning of our solar system. So given that, they essentially are original pieces of the solar system. Now, what we don't understand is that some of them appear to come from other places. And rather than, say, the beginning of our solar system, we have determined as best as possible some of these meteors actually came from Mars, some came from the moon, some came from specific asteroids that we know about. Now, identifying that has been certainly quite a project in terms of figuring out the exact composition of the meteor and matching that to what we know about the composition of the moon or Mars or some of the asteroids. And there are still new things happening. Just this past spring, back in May, there was the announcement that there was the potential for a bright meteor storm, as they call it. That's when, instead of just seeing, say, one every minute or every other minute, you could see perhaps 10 or 15 per minute. Oh, it would almost look like it's raining stars. It didn't come to fruition, but as we learn more about the different orbits of comets, because that's what produces the meteor showers, and how those comets are affected by the gravity of, let's say, Jupiter. Literally, Jupiter can pull a comet off track just by a little bit and change the direction that the particles are orbiting the sun, and therefore how we would be running into them or not running into them.
Excellent. Let's go back to our callers. Hassan is calling from Montreal. Hassan, thanks for calling us this evening. What's your question or comment for Mark?
Hi, I just had a question. I usually start working at 5 o'clock in the morning, and I see the star exactly before sunrise on northeast side of the sun, and it's reddish and it's very bright. And I don't know what is that. Is it a star or is it a planet?
Ah, Hassan, that is a planet. Now, I think its reddish color is similar to seeing, say, a sunrise that appears somewhat reddish. So in other words, it's not really the color of the planet, but instead it's a little bit of our atmosphere. But what you are seeing, and it's a great sight, like you said, around 5 o'clock in the morning, that's the planet Venus. Venus is the brightest planet that we can see. In fact, the only two things that are brighter in the sky are the sun and the moon. So Venus, outstandingly bright, and it's in the morning skies and has been for the past several months. It'll still be there right into, I believe, September. After that, Venus kind of moves, I believe it's behind the sun, and therefore we won't see it for a period of time. It'll return in the evening skies next winter.
Excellent. And we also have a call from Jackson. Jackson's calling from Williamstown. Jackson, thanks for calling this evening. What's your question?
Hi. My father was a farmer when I was a child, and he used to tell me a tale about how the farmers would wait for a certain constellation that you could only see in the wee hours of the morning, and it was shaped like a cow. I believe it was called the Great Cowgon, and that's how they would know what time to get up and milk the cows.
Jackson, you want verification of that? Is that why you're calling?
Well, I just wanted to know if that was just a myth or if that was something that my father was actually telling the truth about.
Well, I don't mean to dispel anything, but I'm pretty certain that's a myth for two reasons. Mm-hmm. Now, I do think that there perhaps was a constellation that they might have recognized at various points. But here's the thing that would suggest that wouldn't work, say, on a year-round basis. As we go around the sun, we're looking in a different direction out into the night sky, whether it's evening, midnight, or toward morning. And so what happens is the stars that you see in the east now are going to be different stars than you're going to see in, say, 3 or 4 months from now. So whatever star group they might have been looking at wouldn't be in the same place 3 or 4 months later. And as an example, one of the things that I often look for, because I'm one of those early risers, is that in August, I start seeing Orion. Mm-hmm. Now, the constellation Orion, most people associate as a winter constellation, and it is. But in August, it's out in the pre-dawn skies.
All right, I want to read a couple emails we have for you. First of all, Nichol in Guilford wrote, I want to put in my annual plug for the Heavens Above website. That's heavens-above.com. It's a great source for information about satellite flyovers and other transient observable events. One great feature about the site is that you can enter your current location, and it will generate a list of upcoming observable events from your location, as well as a star chart pinpointing the sky location of the event. And Nick writes this question. He says, I've seen at least 3 satellites since the program started this evening. Is it possible to tell what type of satellites I'm seeing? And could one of them be the International Space Station?
In some ways, Nichol's comment would help that.
That's right.
There is heavensabove.com. There's also another website that also has a similar feature that helps you track different satellites and so forth that you see in the sky, called spaceweather.com. And so both of them have those applications where you can, Nichol said, you can enter your zip code and it will give you a timing of when those occurrences would be. So as you, as you're looking at those satellite, and I checked this a couple of days ago, so I'm, sometimes my brain isn't right smack on, but I'm pretty sure that the International Space Station is flying over tonight, but I think it's after 10 o'clock.
Okay. Is there a way to tell the difference between a meteor and a satellite?
Yes. One of the things that a satellite does is it travels steadily across the sky, and it doesn't – well, it will fade, or its light will disappear as it gets to a certain point in the sky, but it doesn't have a – you know, like a, let's say, a trail of debris behind it. So it's a very steady, just simply a point of light. As a shooting star or a meteor streaks across the sky, first of all, it'll travel very quickly, much quicker than a satellite. It'll kind of flare and get brighter and then get dimmer, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, if it's bright enough, there's enough debris associated with it. It may leave a very faint, thin trail or tail for a little bit.
You're listening to the Eye on the Sky Stargazing Party on VPR. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211. You can also email questions or comments to community@vpr.net. Mark Breen, let's move back to planets. Mars looks particularly bright this year. Is that the case, and why?
Yeah. Mars, I always find Mars very fascinating because it is the most changeable of the planets in terms of brightness. So in other words, sometimes it's terrifically bright, and other times it's about as faint can be. So it has the greatest range in brightness of any of the planets. And that's because, actually, it's our neighbor. That enhances that possibility. So Mars is bright this year because our orbit and Mars's orbit got as close as they were going to get, and that was somewhere in the neighborhood, I think, of about 50 million miles, and that was back in March. And as they got in that close range, that meant that we were as close to Mars as we were going to be, and so Mars was wonderfully bright. Since that time, Mars has actually been fading in brightness, and yet it's still fairly bright. It's giving us a nice viewing, for example, this evening. And so the fact that Mars takes 2 years to go around the sun and we only take a year means we're going faster, so we're moving away from Mars. Last calculation that I made, I think we're moving away from Mars somewhere in the neighborhood of 60,000 miles per day. So we're getting farther from Mars. It's gradually fading in terms of its brightness, but a slow fade, one that is very enjoyable. Like I said, we're going to see it well into the fall. And so in a year from now, again, thinking about the 1 year and 2 year orbits here, in a year from now, we'll be on the opposite side of the sun from Mars. One, it'll be near the sun, so we're not going to see it at all. And then for an extended period of time after that, it's going to take a long time for us to get closer to Mars. It's going to take a long time for Mars to move farther away from the sun in terms of where we can see it in the sky. And so every other year, Mars is terrifically bright. So we can look for another bright viewing of Mars in April and May of 2016.
And just really quickly, you mentioned it at the top of the hour, but again, if people are outside, how do they find Mars right now?
Yeah, if you're looking over in the southwest, the moon is kind of our little guiding point there. If you look to the right of the moon and just a little lower, we find the planet Saturn, as, you know, again, a fairly bright object. And then farther to the right and lower, that's where you'll see the planet Mars. Mars right now is, say about, if you can kind of imagine, say, three fists held at arm's length above the level horizon. That's about how high Mars is out there. But Mars is kind of the brightest in that area. And then getting much lower now, to the right and lower than Mars, is the star Spica. So there they are.
We have a question from Jody. She asks, so Regulus is 79 light years away. Does that mean the light from that star we see this evening was cast in 1945?
Yes. Good calculation.
Yep. Wow.
Yeah. It is deceptive that not only are we peering way off in the distance, we are literally looking back in time, because it does take, you know, somebody else was asking about, you know, the distance to certain constellations. When we're talking about a star, let's say, she mentioned Regulus, that distance also means it took the light that long to get here. Mm. So The light that started at Regulus is finally getting here tonight. So you're seeing the way it looked in 1945 and not the way it looks now.
Oh, I love it. All right, we've got a lot of callers. Let's try to get as many as we can in before we're finished here. Andre is calling from Brossard, Quebec. Andre, thanks for calling this evening. What's your question for Mark Breen?
Hi. About a week and a half ago, I saw a meteor flash across the sky, south-southeast direction. It had a bright jade emerald tail. Does that indicate any specific information on the composition of the meteor?
I would say yes. I'm not as much of a meteor expert to be able to tell you exactly, you know, what created the green color. If it has various different compositions, most meteors are made out of rock, about 86% of them, something like that. And so within that rock, the various minerals that are involved would help to give it a particular color. In terms of brightness, although we do talk about the Perseid meteor shower, there's actually another meteor shower going on. It's not nearly as famous, and it doesn't produce as many meteors, but it occasionally produces some bright ones like the one that you saw, Andre. And it's known as the Delta Aquarid meteor shower. It just means it appears to come from near the star Delta Aquarius. And so as the meteors originate from that spot, they actually have a different name than the Perseid meteor showers.
All right, let's take another call. Nina is calling from East Hoosick, New York. Nina, thanks for calling this evening.
Hi, thanks. This is a great program. So I'm standing on my deck, and I have a somewhat limited view of the entire sky from where I'm standing. Mm-hmm. But my question is this. Am I looking at Cygnus the Swan, which looks like three stars in a row equidistant from each other, and then what might be the tail?
Okay,
is that
which
part of the summer sky? I don't know how to identify it any better because... Mm-hmm. Where it's located in relationship to other constellations. I was looking for Cassiopeia. I can't see it.
Okay. So let me just ask you, which direction are you looking? Or do you know?
I am looking toward the east.
Okay.
A little bit southeast, mostly east, and up. You know, almost at the top, almost at the zenith.
Yeah. I'm going to say that indeed, I think you are looking at Cygnus. Cygnus, the tail of Cygnus, is actually one of the stars in the summer triangle. The brightest is part of a different constellation. So we're looking at the dimmest of the trio, and that star would form the tail. And so kind of pointing toward the south from that tail, there would be three stars that would form the body, the neck, and the head. And then crossing that would be the three stars that I think you're referring to, and those would form essentially the wings. In fact, that basic T shape gives it its other name. Cygnus is also known as the Northern Cross.
Wow, that's lovely. Well, Nina really did pick it out, didn't she?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Let's take one more call. We have Sandy calling from Castleton. Sandy, thanks for calling this evening.
Hi. I just called because several years ago I worked at Half Moon State Park, and we would regularly on Wednesday nights take anybody interested to Hubbardton Battlefield, which is exit 5 off of 4, Route mm-hmm. 4. And it's a bit of a ride up there, but the sky is just magnificent from there. Unfortunately, tonight we've cut some cloud cover, so we're peering between clouds, but that's okay. It's up there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that you can probably go in there any night and look around. Actually, that was some lightning from somewhere. but it's a good place to look. There isn't any light around to make a mess out of your viewing.
Mm-hmm.
Nice open field there in Hubbardton. Great. Thanks,
okay.
Sandy.
Thanks, Sandy.
And what a great activity for someone to take children out, young people out, to kind of orient them to the night sky.
Yeah, and actually, Sandy reminds me that, so somebody had asked earlier about, dark locations, and those are certainly wonderful spots to look. But we are fortunate in our general listening area that many locations are adequately dark in terms of viewing the sky. And so just consider getting away from any visible light that you can see. And in general, you know, even in most of our smaller towns and villages, all you have to do is get away from, you know, sort of directly being in the light. And in general, we have a pretty nice dark sky. Obviously, the larger urban-like areas, obviously Montreal, but also thinking in the Burlington area and down toward Rutland, these somewhat larger population centers, obviously a little tougher. But you don't have to travel far from those locations to get a nice dark sky.
Now, Mark, we've talked about constellations, different stars, meteors, the showers. Let's pan out for a moment and talk about the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy itself, which we are inside of. So what are some key things we should know about it?
Well, one of the trickier things is sort of to imagine, you know, the view that we have of the Milky Way. So we've talked, I think, enough about some of those constellations that we can actually go back to. And so think about the Scorpion over in the south, because when you look at it, you'll see patches of the Milky Way right there. And it actually traces a path from there right through the Summer Triangle, nearly overhead, and then curves down into the north and fades out just a little bit. The reason that there's a path there is because you're looking sideways through a disk of stars. That's a little challenging to sort of imagine. I actually use kind of, it's a little bit silly, but I tell people to imagine you're in an Oreo cookie. Because you know that the shape of the cream filling is flat and round, and that's the shape of our galaxy. So you're in the cream filling looking out, looking sideways. And so when you do, you have to look through the cream filling, and that's what you're seeing displayed up in the sky. So in other words, obviously not cream filling, but looking through the thickest band of stars, looking sideways through the Milky Way galaxy. So that's what we're looking at. Now, as I mentioned before, all of the stars that we see are in the Milky Way galaxy. Our sun is a member of this particular galaxy. We're not in the center. We're about two-thirds of the way out from the middle. In the direction of the Scorpion, you are looking toward the center of the galaxy, and that's why the Milky Way is a little bit brighter over there. And you're looking out to the very fringes of it if you look off to the north. And so the Milky Way is a little less pronounced in that part of the sky.
And anything else throughout the year that they should be looking at in the galaxy?
Well, one of the things that, about the Milky Way is that, you know, through the seasons, it changes its placement in the sky. And it's kind of one of those three-dimensional things to try to imagine, so don't. instead, know that the Milky Way is nice and prominent most of the year. In April, though, as Orion and his winter stars settle down to the horizon, the Milky Way gets level and it pretty much sits right on the horizon and therefore pretty unviewable through late April, May, and into a good part of June. So if you're looking for the Milky Way, late spring is not the time for you. But once we get into summer, it starts lifting up into the sky. And so we get a great view of it from now all the way through the early part of next spring. Also, because you're looking through the thickest part of the galaxy when you're doing that, most bright stars are somewhere near the Milky Way. So that includes the Summer Triangle that I mentioned. It includes Scorpio that I mentioned. It includes Cassiopeia, the Queen. And then later on, going into the fall and winter, Orion is near the Milky Way as well.
Mark, I want to thank you for another fascinating hour of the night sky.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Mark Breen is the planetarium director at the Fairbanks Museum in St. Johnsbury, as well as an Eye on the Sky meteorologist and host of Eye on the Night Sky every weekday afternoon on VPR. This has been the Eye on the Sky Stargazing Party presented in collaboration with the Fairbanks Museum in St. Johnsbury. The program was produced by Peter Biello with production assistance from Catherine Hayes. Mary Williams directed the show, and I'm Rick Singeri. Thanks for listening, and have a great night.